Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. No less than Mark Twain looked at the long end of America's 19th century with its railroad barons and opulent rich and dubbed it the Gilded Age. Rockefeller, Carnegie, glittering mansions, vast fortunes, corrupt politics. With today's billion-dollar paydays and spiraling concentration of wealth, many see a new Gilded Age around us. Now our own Jack Beatty has put on his historian's hat to go back and dig into the country's first reign of riches and money politics. In a big new book, he calls it The Age of Betrayal. Up next on Point, Jack Beatty goes deep on the politics and pertinence of the first Gilded Age. Joining me in the studio is Jack Beatty, On Point News analyst, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly, and prodigious writer. His 2001 anthology, Colossus, How the Corporation Changed America, was named one of the 10 best business books of the year. He's written big books on Peter Drucker, the management guru, and Boston Mayor James Michael Curley in The Rascal King. His new book is Age of Betrayal, The Triumph of Money in America, 1865 to 1900. Jack Beatty, wonderful to have you in this chair, in this role today. Thank you for being here, and congratulations on bringing out this splendid new book.
Thank you.
Just brimming with the fervor that you bring to us every time you're on. You know, we have images of the Gilded Age. We think we know what it's about, railroad fortunes and barons and Astors and Rockefellers and Carnegies. And on the other side of that, labor unrest and industrialization and the pain that comes with it. But you put the stamp betrayal on it in perhaps the biggest way I've ever seen this stamp on this age. Point to us to begin, before we get into the details, the betrayal or betrayals, as I read your book. What were they? What the expectation that you see let down in those years after the Civil War?
Yeah, in reading about the 90s, the 1890s, I kept coming across this feeling that the country had taken a wrong turn, that things had not worked out the way people thought they were at the end of the Civil War. Rutherford B. Hayes crystallized this in his diary in 1886, where he wrote, we are a nation, we are a government not of the people, by the people, and for the people, but of the corporation, by the corporation, and for the corporation. This is the president of the United States.
In his diary,
in his presidential policies. So what happened? What went wrong? Well, you know, three promises, I think, were made to Americans explicitly and sort of implicitly. By the Civil War, one of course was the promise of emancipation for the 4 million freedmen. The second promise was the promise of what Lincoln said: government by the people, of the people, democracy. That government would be returned to the people. You see, because in the lead up to the Civil War, the Southern planters dominated government.
Not just in their region, but through the dynamics of that time nationally.
That's right.
And what less could you promise Americans for all the blood spilled in the Civil War than that it would be of, by, and for them?
Yes, and you know, the planters called Lincoln's voters mudsills and mechanics. And the mudsills and mechanics were going to have their own government after the war.
That was Honest Abe's promise.
That was the promise. And the third promise allied to that was this complicated idea of free labor. Lincoln thought that for the Republican Party, the vital thing in life was what they called the right to rise. Mm-hmm. The right to rise. That's what the Republicans were for. And the right to rise essentially meant no classes in this country.
No economic classes.
And Lincoln's model was, you know, a penniless fellow works on a farm for a while, saves his money, then he buys his little farm. Pretty soon he hires another penniless farmer, or if it's a shop, another person to work in the shop. That person saves money. That person owns a business and goes on. That is how Rising worked.
And Lincoln's own political story was the personification of
absolutely,
this. Absolutely.
As was the bobbin boy of Massachusetts politics, the first Republican Speaker of the House, Nathaniel Banks, who began as a bobbin boy in a New England mill and became Speaker of the House of Representatives, the right to rise. All of these promises were betrayed after the war.
In the span of 40 years, the most terrible war ever, and then off they go, the promise of the free life of the slave, of government of, by, and for the people, and the right to rise, as Abe Lincoln had it. So take us back to how this happened. I mean, remind us of those circumstances of those years. You paint vividly what the railroads and industrialization did to this country. There's the economic context.
That is the economic context. And indeed, the economic context, I think, really made the right to rise, as Lincoln saw it, outmoded, a nostalgic ideal, even when he announced it for most people. Because even when he was speaking, the economy was shifting toward wage labor. The Republicans didn't like that because the Southern apologists for slavery spoke of wages slavery and, you know, the slaves in the New England mills. And to them, they saw no difference.
They tried to equate the two.
They
did. What's the difference between a wage earner and a slave?
That's right.
Because
they
have to work hour by hour.
And in fact, they in a famous poem, the hireling and the slave, they pointed out that at least we take care of our slaves when they're old and can't work. Out in the New England mill, you just throw them out
like
in the snow.
But why did it turn out that way? You vividly describe how the railroads really opened up America, that until you had first the Erie Canal, but then really the railroads, you had two countries, one east of the Alleghenies, the other west. The railroads clearly brought economic boom times in many areas, so why not the free labor? Why didn't it liberate all those individuals to find their, you know, economic destiny?
Because the railroad made possible one of the cardinal discoveries of modern life, scale and scope production. The big kind of production that we all recognize as essential. Alfred Chandler calls that the dynamics of industrial capitalism. Before the railroad, you couldn't get sufficient supply to keep a constant turn of production. And before the railroad, you lost customers to distance. You couldn't have a wider market. The railroad made both those things possible. And once scale and scope production started to work, the small man couldn't compete. Can't compete today, really. That's why people talk about branding, ways to avoid scale and scope production. But in the 19th century, it just tended to knock the small man out of the business. I use the example of the Akron butcher. He's trying to sell his product, and Armour, which was one of the first Chicago meat packers, one of the first
giant
to practice scale and scope production.
With refrigerated rail cars.
They come with one of their refrigerator cars, they park it in Akron, and they say, we're doing a sale off the car.
So the Walmart of its day.
And the guy is out of business. You know, he says, I'll have to go work for Armour, I guess. And that happened all over the country in meat and then in other canned goods and other things. And that just made it. That essentially, first of all, people worked in these places, wage labor, bigness. There were returns to scale. The bigger the entity, the more returns.
And they worked hard and long. We'll look at labor, but Carnegie with the 12-hour day, sometimes
right,
the 7-day
right,
week,
right? And
the steel mills,
and they and there was just less opportunity for the small man. And if he were a farmer, he was fighting the tailwind, which was really deflation, steady agricultural fall in agricultural prices, partly because of the increase of supply made
with
possible
the railroad,
by the railroad.
Competing with everybody.
That's right. That's right.
That's familiar to people listening today. The wealth then created flowing, in a sense, over those rails to the top.
Yes.
How did the concentration of wealth, we hear a lot about this these days, Paul Krugman writing a lot about it just recently, yep, many other people, we've spoken of it often, but how did the concentration of wealth in the Gilded Age at its peak compare to the concentration of wealth we see today?
We're not quite to that point. I think one estimate, I quote an 1890 study, of the 1890 census done then, which basically said that the top 11,000 families in the country had more than the rest, all put together.
1890.
We haven't arrived there, but we're moving back to that. If you look at the studies of wealth inequality in America today, we're back to about 1911, before the income tax. We're moving backward. in that regard. That is the incidence of inequality is growing. The gap between the rich and the rest mm-hmm. is growing back to, it's almost eating its way through the 20th century back into the
back to the 19th. And the political influence and power that came with that, you've got wonderful illustrations in the book. Here's one of these enormous guys in their top hats and fancy top coats, huge-bellied titans of industry with on their bellies written here, Steel Beam Trust, Copper Trust, Sugar Trust, Coal. And they're looking over the United States Senate, where the senators look like little boys at school desks doing the bidding of big money in those days. Now, we're used to money politics. How do you compare those two then and now, the influence of money?
I think there's a great deal of resemblance. I call the book The Triumph of Money in America partly just over that, money over politics. This book ends with the campaign of 1896 in which William McKinley spent an estimated $16 million to William Jennings Bryan's $600,000. And that $16 million today represents almost what is being spent today. And so money overrode politics, and it did it in two ways. One, in terms of bribes, I talk about how railroads essentially got their land grants by showering bonds on capital. Bonds mm-hmm. fell like snowflakes on Capitol Hill, and there was open bidding for people for senators. But it also sort of set the agenda. This is what politics was going to be about: making these people happy, and further. The money brought something that historians don't often point out, repression. This was some historians use the phrase domestic militarism.
The Pinkerton Guards and all
and
the rest.
And the National Guards, mm-hmm. called out to put down over 120 strikes in 20 years, 30 years.
The most violent labor conflicts in the world.
In the world.
Time. Let's take a call from Chris in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Chris, you're on the air.
How you doing, Tom? How you doing, Jack?
Hi.
I'm calling because my great-great-great-grandfather was a robber baron during the Gilded Age. He's one of the forgotten robber barons. He lived in the Hudson River Valley, right next to FDR and the Vanderbilts. And it's a personal point I'd like to bring up.
Yes.
My grandfather would never really talk about it, but he always wanted to put across that life was really, really boring and cold. For him.
You mean being that rich, growing up in that mansion on the Hudson?
Exactly. He didn't like it at all, and actually when he was old enough to move away, he did.
But Chris, when you look back on that time, do you see your robber baron forebear as a hero of industrialization or as an agent of betrayal of the American promise?
That's a good question. I see him as both in a way. He was a modest man, apparently. I mean, he didn't live modestly. But he wasn't one of the people throwing his money around in politics. He lived in the Hudson River Valley year-round and actually kept to himself along with his family. So I think I see him as a mixture of both.
How did he make his money, Chris?
He started in steel and then married into the Coleman family who ran the railroads.
Oh.
A little bit of each.
Yeah.
Not too shabby.
Not bad.
Not too shabby. Chris, thanks for the personal link there. Jack, take us in there. Here's one of the issues that's raised. Industrialization was brutal basically everywhere, mm-hmm. Not least in this country, because you went from, as you say, people having their own to working for the wage, and the wages were low and tough, and there weren't labor laws and all the rest when it began. And yet, going through that transformation put the United States in a position to be a huge world power in the 20th century. So was there another way? I mean, you look at the Soviet Union in your book and say, my God, that was even worse. Stalin just marched everybody through the most brutal kind of stripping of personal dignity and means. Could the U.S. have done it another way, or are you suggesting it shouldn't have done it at all?
Well, I don't know whether I think it had to do it. That was just the force of history impelling us. But you're right. We went from being an agricultural Arcady in the 1850s to being Germany's equal as an industrial power in 1914. Mm. And how did that happen? Well, I mean, it happened partly through an industrial policy, the tariff, which I show how it essentially allowed American capital industries to grow without foreign competition. But this question about industrialization, you're right, it happened here, but this was the first place it happened, full industrialization with a fully mobilized electorate. In mm-hmm. other places, you know, when it happened in Britain, most people couldn't vote. In Germany, very limited franchise. Mm-hmm. America, the first time full democracy meets full industrialization. Mm-hmm. What gives?
Mm-hmm.
Democracy. And one of the reasons is that this is what economic historians call sort of the period of accumulation. That in order to grow, in order to hit what Walt Rostow called the takeoff point in industrialization,
mm-hmm.
the savings rates of economies have to sort of much go up to 12%, something like that. It would effectively have to double.
And did that in the robber baron's bank account.
That's exactly it. Savings has to come out of someplace.
Mm-hmm.
And savings essentially means less consumption, mm-hmm. more money to reinvest. And the less consumption came out of essentially out of people's wage. They were paid less than by their productivity they would earn.
How did those people, the people then, understand that at the time? Were they thinking to themselves, well, we have to hit a certain takeoff point here, and so, you know, fine by me, you can pay me as lousy as you like because it's for the greater good and the greater glory.
No, I quote, and I have a chapter called Revolution from Above, and I quote Barrington Moore Jr., who's the great student of how nations went into the modern world, social origins of dictatorship and democracy. And he says that nowhere have the mass of the people ever wanted industrialization. Everywhere it has been a revolution from above, led by a ruthless minority. And
because
so here.
Because the pain of getting there was
so deep.
The pain
of getting there was so great. I mean, certainly in Soviet Russia, where they industrialized over 15 years, the pain was collectivism, mass terror. I mean, that was, but here it was exploitation, and it was the state and business essentially suppressing workers' opportunities to change, to better their condition.
But you describe many betrayals here, not least, if I read you right, Jack, of the electorate of itself.
Yeah.
It kind of rolled over for this, in your view, and you paint the reasons for that. Share that.
Well, one reason was, as someone said, this the United States was two countries in that period joined by force of arms. The war really still made us two nations, and the war divided the country. The Republicans, would have these what they call bloody shirt campaigns, where they would
vote as you shot.
Vote as you shot. You can't vote for the Democrats. Vote against them, because after all, these are the people that led the rebellion.
Meanwhile, Democrats were the South.
That's the South. Meanwhile, in the South, their bogey was Negro domination. You vote for a Republican or a populist,
mm-hmm.
and you're going to get Reconstruction back here. You're going to get those Yankee bayonets. Stay with the democracy, as they call the Democratic Party. So you have anomalies. You have small farmers in the South and farm laborers voting the same party as the planters, their exploiters. In the North, you have mill workers voting the same party as the mill owners.
So the wedge issue of that day, race as now, or certainly in the 1980s and later, only on a much greater scale.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And sectionalism built around the race question was really the central sort of axis of politics then. People couldn't escape. It was a politics of memory. And people couldn't, the big line was the party of the fathers. I quote a Colorado paper criticizing the populists, saying, don't vote for these populists. You may not have fought in the war, but your father did.
Mm-hmm.
And you owe loyalty to the party of the fathers. And, of course, meanwhile, the party of the fathers was thoroughly sold out to big corporate interests. But it had the bloody shirt, and it waved it.
And stick with them what brung you. Yeah. Let's take a call from Cromwell, Connecticut. And Mel, hi, Mel, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I teach history, and one of the things we talk about in my classes is the various Supreme Court decisions that undermine state laws and rules that protected workers in individual states. One of the most infamous supposedly gave personhood to corporations was the Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railway decision, which has been cited as treating the corporation as a person, which gives them the right of free speech and so on. I was just wondering what your comments were on that.
Well, Mel, I'm so glad you raised. That's a huge issue in Jack's book, Age of Betrayal. Jack, take us into some of that history.
I devote two chapters to this. One, the inverted Constitution tells how the 14th Amendment, which was passed by Congress to protect the rights of the freedmen in the South, was taken away from the freedmen, essentially was abridged and narrowed to the point of meaninglessness. And on the and then in the second chapter, the scandal of Santa Clara, I show how the person, it turned out, that the whose life, liberty, and property and the 14th Amendment protected, turned out to be the corporation. And this amazing change of an amendment passed to make good on the promise of emancipation became, in fact, the shield of incorporated wealth.
And astoundingly, not even through the decision written, as you describe it, Jack, but through the kind of little reporter's note or preamble on that Supreme Court decision. And describe what happened there and how the country responded to it. Today, every time the Supreme Court marches up to a big decision, we're all over it, or the media's all over it. Was the country paying attention to these tiny maneuvers with such enormous consequences?
The answer is no. People couldn't see what the consequences would be. And in fact, the Reconstruction decisions, I talk about the slaughterhouse cases and the Cruikshank decision, which essentially gave a free pass to terrorism in the South, white terrorism. These were greeted with great approbation in the North because there was a hunger all over the country for reunion. That with capital R, and some people call it the romance of reunion. North and South joined at the marriageable daughter. That happens in novel after novel of the period.
So is this a rights versus reunion? You describe a setting in Faneuil Hall in Boston where someone says, but what about the Negro and everything we fought for? And somebody, I forget what they say, they shout out at him.
That's over. Sit down.
Enough of that already.
Yeah, right. It was Wendell Phillips, the great abolitionist, saying, "My concern is with the hunted, hounded, murdered Negro in Louisiana." And, of course, I go through that here, how horrible the Louisiana situation was.
The Colfax slaughter.
Colfax massacre, mm-hmm. Yeah. And of course, which went unpunished because of this incredible betrayal that happened at the Supreme Court. And, of course, it's even more tragic because, as I point out, the justice who wrote the slaughterhouse cases, which limited the reach of the 14th Amendment, Samuel Miller, was a proponent of rights for black people, was a fervent, almost an abolitionist.
Why'd you do it?
Because, as I show in a complicated interchange, he was trying to preserve federalism against the argument made on the part of the opposition that a law passed by the Louisiana legislature establishing a slaughterhouse was an interference in economic rights. And he basically said, well, my gosh, if through the 14th Amendment we could reach in and take away state regulation and suspend state laws, mm-hmm. What will happen? There'll be nothing left of the states. And by the way, any labor legislation or progressive legislation or women's protection, child labor, that can be overridden because it can be seen as a violation of economic rights.
So the corporation wins the same protection as American citizens.
That's right.
This corporate body.
And that decision still lingers in the Buckley case of 1976, which said that political that campaign ads are speech.
Right.
That invoked the Santa Clara decision because the speakers were corporations. That's their right to speak.
And this back before the Supreme Court.
Now,
all of this not happening in a vacuum. You've got these super rich so-called robber barons of the time looking over the shoulder of politicians and of the court. You go into great depth on the machinations of these guys. I mean, they were pulling the strings very, very deliberately of a whole nation here.
They were. But you also mentioned that the voters went for it. And in some ways, they went for it because the corporation was not legitimized, but I think people began as the decades wore on to understand the benefits of bigness, which really are the same ones we have today. Goods were cheaper.
Mm-hmm.
You could communicate easier. That there was just benefits to it, and people began to buy into the corporate system. But as I point out, there was a debate over the nature of America in the 1880s, and the corporation was very much up for debate then. Americans regarded it as an illegitimate form. They saw it as violating their Republican birthright. They feared that the corporation would be a government within a government, mm-hmm. that it would corrupt politics, that it would override the republic. Justice Brandeis has an eloquent passage about this where he says it was fear of the corporation that kept the business corporation so long, really, here tethered to the state. And it was only in this era that it broke free of the state and, with the Santa Clara decision, essentially walked away as free as a person.
But the country began to feel the benefits at a
certain
point.
Right.
It was tough.
That's right.
Then the benefits began to come. You write about the Werner Sombart saying that scarcity and socialism founder on America's shoals of roast beef. There was enough to keep all that at bay. Are you saying that there's a kind of self-betrayal here, Jack, that this country, over a very long stretch of time, sold out something essential to democracy for the material joys of consumer society?
I don't know that I'd put it that strongly. I just think these things happened. What really happened is this. At the turn of the century, there was a great merger movement. Something like 1,500 companies were compacted overnight into 150. And suddenly you had not just big corporations, but giants. And the corporations who did that realized that they were fighting this Republican, small r, mm-hmm. American tradition. Socialism wasn't American. Republicanism mm-hmm. was, mm-hmm. believing that people needed to be economically independent mm-hmm. in order to be free citizens.
Fully realized.
Fully realized.
Americans.
That's mm-hmm. right. Be uninfluenced by the needs of their bellies mm-hmm. when they cast their vote, and mm-hmm. be uncoerced by their employers. This was the Republican ideal. Mm-hmm. This was what was against the corporation. This is what furnished the populists and others with their vocabulary of critique. But the corporations, those mergers having happened, they had to justify them, and they mounted huge advertising campaigns and public mm. relations campaigns. AT&T fought for 20 years to fight off government ownership, which was happening all over, mm. government ownership of telephones and telegraph. All over the world, mm-hmm. yeah. And they did it successfully by simply, reminding, but changing the image of the corporation. The soulless corporation really wasn't soulless. There's a wonderful book about this by a man named Roland Marchand showing how really they recognized they had to sell it, and they sold what they were doing partly on this basis of consumerism. Look, you may not like this bigness, and by the way, I know you don't like us corrupting politics, so we're not going to fight too hard when Teddy Roosevelt passes a law banning corporate contributions. Okay, we're out of politics now.
But, of course, that was the end of the game.
That's right. So we're all out of politics now. We're not going to corrupt government now, but we're going to give you cheaper goods. Mm-hmm. And we're going to give you more productivity because, strangely enough, the market doesn't work. The corporation replaced the market in great part. Corporations were anti-competitive because mm-hmm. they internalized functions that used to be done by the market. And people would say, this old kind of 19th century entrepreneurial economy, it was not stable. People could go out of business overnight. You couldn't make investments in real heavy, in capital mm-hmm. equipment because it could be, someone could compete with you and drive you out. Let's have this, Rockefeller said, only a professor could believe this Adam Smith stuff. Only a professor could believe that was desirable.
Leave it to us.
The
oligopoly.
That's right.
Wow, wonderful. Jack, we've got a lot of people who want to speak with you, but I wish you'd just remind us for a moment of just what that guilt on the Gilded Age looked like. You described some of the balls there and all the rest. Give us a sense of the swirl around fancy Manhattan in those days.
Yeah, there was the century really ends with this big party, the Bradley Martin Ball, where very rich family inherited, Mrs. Martin inherited $7 million, held a huge ball, rented the Waldorf, and it was really almost celebrating the defeat of William Jennings Bryan. It was like saying, "Well, he's
that populist
thank
is out
heaven
of here.
We don't have to worry about him." And I detail what the ball was like, with people dressed as J.P. Morgan wearing a Molière costume, his daughter appearing as Pocahontas.
John Jacob Astor with his diamond-studded sword.
Diamond-studded sword, and there were no less than a dozen women coming dressed as Marie Antoinette.
And the windows of the Waldorf boarded over and nailed closed while the hundreds of police protected all this from outside.
That's right, that's right. Yeah, this is wonderfully detailed in a spectacular book by Sven Burkert at Harvard on called The Moneyed Metropolis, which really is the best book about the Gilded Age.
Yeah, it's quite a picture. Let's go to Winsocky, Vermont, and Bobby, you're on the air, Bobby.
Yes, hi. First of all, I want to say that I believe socialism is the only answer to these problems, but I was in four unions, ranging from really mild nothing unions, the retail clerks union, to a very militant local Ford assembly. And I think that I don't entirely blame, it's hard to phrase this, but I don't entirely blame the unions, but they have been utterly destroyed, and there's no protection to the worker, none. The government absolutely will do nothing for them. And
you mean today, Bob? You mean today?
Today.
But when you look back on that time, I mean, if you were in unions, you must know the history.
It's the same difference. I mean, Big Bill Haywood, those guys, you know, they were murdered. People were murdered to prevent unionism. And the change was that now they buy off the union.
So, Bobby, if unions had been stronger, if they were stronger today, do you think it would cut down on that productivity and the consumer products that people enjoy so much, or would it just be a better sharing of what's produced?
I don't think productivity is a word that we should all genuflect to. Productivity means people work harder for essentially the same money or less. And when we talk about the goods that we get from overseas, that's the height of productivity, but people are just screwed.
Well, of course, productivity growth has been pretty high here as well. Jack, speak to Bobby.
Well, Bobby, we're at about, I saw the other day, 7% of the private sector workforce is now in unions. When I was a young man, When I was a young man, it was 36%. Mm. And, of course, the fall in American real wages parallels the descent of unions, and I think that's a national calamity for the middle class, for people that want for the right to rise. In those days, unions had it really, really tough. And I point out how Samuel Gompers was effectively driven from politics by an overactive judiciary. There was a doctrine called liberty of contract that arose out of these cases I talk about. And under this doctrine, you couldn't have minimum wage laws or laws governing hours of employment because you interfered with the liberty of contract on the part of the individual employee to make his bargain with management. Thus, you know, a law in I think Illinois saying something about the, you know, limiting the hours that breaker boys could work in the coal mines, mm-hmm. boys who would essentially take out the slag from the coal. Mm-hmm. That was an interference in the breaker boys' liberty of contract.
They wanted to work that way.
They should be able to work that out with the right. Downstate coal companies themselves.
Sure. No problem.
This doctrine.
Please, sir, may I have some more?
This doctrine was unbelievable, and the havoc that it wrought with all labor protection, so that Gompers succeeded in the 80s in getting the New York State Legislature to pass a bill limiting the sweating out system, you know, where work would be sent home to people, mm-hmm. and cigars and all sorts of things made mm-hmm. in the home, mm-hmm. limiting the hours people could work. And the Supreme Court, first the New York courts and then the Supreme Court's court, call that a violation of liberty of contract. And so Gomper said that we can't work at all through the system. The only hope for labor is the strike and working it out company by company. And he withdrew the AFL from active political involvement.
But when they took the other path, the Gatling guns came out.
Well, that's right. I have a chapter on the Great Railroad Strike of 1877 where Pittsburgh was turned into a scene of urban warfare with Gatling guns spraying the street with 17 people shot on a hillside by National Guardsmen, panicked by a mob, with every building, every piece of property, owned by the Pennsylvania Railroad, hated in the state, burnt to a crisp in Pittsburgh. And I show that, yeah, that the omnipresent threat of the National Guard, not just to break the strike, but to shoot the striker.
But then you quote, and I forget the historian saying, this is from the 1950s, saying, if we hadn't put the pedal to the metal, and yes, it was brutal, yes, it was hard, but if we hadn't done that, we would not have pulled abreast of, let's say, Germany. World War I could have gone the other way. The world would be a different place, which is a bitter but necessary price to pay for America's place in the world.
That's the argument people say, but that assumes that this concentration of wealth all went into the productive mechanisms of the economy, mm-hmm. and we see today that it doesn't. Just a column by Krugman today says profits are way up, investment no. Wait, what's happening? Well, companies are buying back their stock with mm-hmm. that profit. Why? Because it enriches the pay packages of the CEOs. That's a kind of looting, you know. And that went on all through the Gilded Age, where there was just, in fact, our whole idea of the Gilded Age is people buying frippery and throwing their money away on you know, baubles and
diamond-studded sword handles
and so on, not putting it into plant and equipment. You know,
and yet those railroads were built. Those steel mills were built. America did become an industrial titan.
It did. It did. And it may be that it did in spite of this incredible overhead, the superflux that flowed to the very wealthy.
Let's take a call from Harrisonburg, Virginia, and Russell. Hi, Russell. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
And I really am enjoying your discussion. One thing that I think is really significant is how people are so, by instinct, addicted to labels for ourselves and for others. And people don't really think about what the label means. And one of them, for instance, is communism, where communism, in theory, was of the people, by the people, for the people, just like the U.S. Constitution, just like Jefferson, and just like Lincoln. But in reality, in a lot of cases, communism became a brutal dictatorship, which is what people have come to despise about communism in this country.
Mm-hmm.
Yet, when any country around the world, like China or Vietnam or El Salvador or Nicaragua, or in this country where the workers try to strike for better wages and working conditions, one of the tools that the people with the power and the money use is they say, well, they're communists or they're socialists, and people just start having a fit about that, and then there's just tremendous negative feelings toward the people trying to be Americans and get better wages and working conditions.
Yep. So they live under, I mean, Jack Beatty writes it as well. You saw the brutality of what happened in communist systems, yet the label may push out a third way, if that's what Russell's describing here. Jack, if that's what you're suggesting.
Well, the label was certainly brandished in the 19th century. One of my discoveries here was how much the Paris Commune, that brief period in 1871 when the workers of Paris essentially ran the city and shot a lot of priests, but on the other hand, but weren't all that radical. I think the most radical measure they passed had to do with the hours that butchers could work or bakers. But then the commune was violently and barbarously put down by the French army, shooting something like 20 or 30,000 prisoners, communards taken prisoner. But the commune frightened the hell out of property in America. And right away they saw the commune, and the labor union and the strike as all part of the same thing. So that, you know, they would talk about a communistic, who started the Chicago fire?
Mm-hmm.
Someone from the Internationale representing the commune. Mm. You know, someone strikes in St. Louis, they call it the Commune of St. Louis. Mm. And communism, which we think of as something that frightens us after the Cold War, was a fright word right from the 1870s on, and was used again and again against any sort of effort by the part of workers against radicalism.
12 hours a day, take the wage, or you're going to have
communist.
This placard around your
yeah.
neck. Lee's calling from Waltham, Massachusetts. Lee, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi, everybody.
Hi.
You know, I'm an independent trucker, and I'm in the bottom of the food chain, and the Gilded Age hasn't really left. I mean, the robber barons have just changed industries. Like, the new industry today is, I guess it's fucked by them. But new industry today are the oil companies, and with help of the Friends of the Futures markets, they're the ones who basically control my life.
Why, Lee, if we've got a democracy, every man and woman's got a vote, why should it be that way?
Because, well, because they have enormous influence. I talk to congressmen all the time, and these guys would rather, you know, jump out a window than crawl out on a limb and criticize corporations.
Rather jump out a window than crawl out on a limb. I love it. Lee, thanks very much for your call. Jack, it goes right to the front piece of your book here. You quote Aristotle saying oligarchy is when the men of property have the government in their hands, Aristotle in his Politics. And then Frederick Jackson Turner, each age writes the history of the past anew with reference to the conditions uppermost in his own time. It seems Lee's onto your theme right there.
Well, I mean, I did write this book with a sense of my own time. I do think this is a time when government does not serve. I quote from a report of the American Political Science Association. They said government does not hear the voices of the people who change the bedpans, who sweep the floors, who collect the garbage. That's just a fact. Government is not about them. It is about, and part of that is because half the people don't vote. And as I point out, how that happened at the turn of the century, how we went from this fully mobilized electorate, where in the Middle West in the 1896 election, 95% of the people voted, to half the people. And how that happened around the turn of the century. And one of the ironies, of course, is the progressive movement, which we think of as the solvent of the worst of the Gilded Age. Mm. Well, you know, if in the Gilded Age corruption was the enemy of democracy, in the progressive era, reform was. Because there were movements essentially to bring in literacy tests on voting. Of course, the Southern states stripped voting entirely from African Americans. Mm. There were personal registration laws, which hadn't existed before. The state registered people to vote. And all of these were ways in which the electorate was shrunk down. Now, some people say it was a byproduct of reform. Mm. Some people see it as deliberate effort to get the rabble out of politics. But the fact is that turnout in presidential races went from the high of about 80% in, I think, 1880 to as low as in the 30s by the mid-1920s.
Mm. Down it went. Let's get a call from Panama City, Florida. And Kent, hi, Kent. You're on the air with Jack Beatty.
Thank you. Good morning.
Hi.
I think we're overlooking the fact that even though the workers might suffer somewhat, they're not in serfdom. The lowest paid workers today have air conditioning, color television, automobiles.
Yes, indeed.
Even though the rising tide lifts all boats is not a popular thing to hear anymore, it certainly is true. Let's just compare the workers to 10 years ago. Let's compare them to 50 years ago, 100 years ago.
Kent, it's a well-made point and one that sits in many Americans' minds when they look at this scene, Jack.
Well, I don't know about that, Kendall. You say compare it 50 years ago. I remember 40 years ago. In the 1960s, real wages, real family incomes went up, I think, 41% over the decade. Real family wages, effectively, since 1973, have been flat or fallen. Meanwhile, the wage incomes of people at the top have risen mercurially. Has the rising tide, the tide is rising, but those boats aren't going up. And, of course, one of the reasons is the institutional change. In the 1960s, 35% private sector workforce in unions, today, 9-7%. So I'm not really so sure that the average person is doing better today than someone did in the 1960s. And that because partly of tax laws. Taxes were as high into the 1980s on big wealth as 70%. Of course, they didn't all pay that, but at least that was the rate was up there. And of course, ever since, the taxes on the very wealthy have come way, way down, cut in half almost since then. So I don't buy your premise that for average people, they've never had it so good.
On the other hand, industrialization produced a consumer society like never before seen. We wanted to quote Woodrow Wilson, but our time grows short. But you do quote, in your retrospect, you quote the president in 1913 saying, "We have been proud of our industrial achievements, but we have not hitherto stopped thoughtfully enough to count the human cost." Here we are, 2007, and the charge of Gilded Age is raised again. You're right, Gilded Age politics induces pertinent despair about democracy. We've just got a minute, Jack, but what's your conclusion? Does the vision that you see as a kind of high point of aspiration for American democracy, does it ever find its full expression?
I you know, it finds periods, it seems to me, when government works for ordinary people. When government, I think the New Deal was such a time. But what did that take? That took a discrediting of the entire oligarchy of wealth. It took a discrediting of the malefactors of great wealth, as Teddy Roosevelt called. Mm-hmm. And it took people to recognize, by gosh, if I'm unemployed, it's not because I lack pluck or moral fortitude. It's because this system has failed. It was the failure of capitalism that required some state intervention on the part of the ordinary person. And that came not out of the goodness of the heart of the Roosevelt administration, because all over this country, people sat down on the jobs. There were strikes. There were demonstrations. The people banged on the door, and they say, we'll be heard, and they were.
And, of course, it took a depression to bring that.
Right.
Let's hope we don't have to walk that road again. Jack Beatty, it's a terrific history, Age of Betrayal, The Triumph of Money in America, 1865 to 1900. So that's what you're doing in hours off the air, Jack. Great work.
You thought I was counting my money.
Yeah, right. Clink, clink, clink. Jack, wonderful to have you. Congratulations on bringing out Age of Betrayal.
Thanks
for being
so
with
much.
Us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Thank you.